being stilled. He caught himself hugging Ruthie's stuffed bunny tight. "Every night they did it, and we all had to stand and watch," his father whispered. "We had to stand and watch, and we couldn't say a word, couldn't move a muscle, or we would be next." Tears rolled down Joseph's cheeks. He thought about how he'd treated his father at the Cuban doctor's examination, how he'd made his father believe he was back in that place where he'd seen so many awful things. "I can't go back there," his father whispered. "Can't go back." His father closed his eyes and put his head between his knees, and soon he was asleep. Joseph sat with his sleeping parents until the cabin started to get dark, and he couldn't put off finding Ruthie any longer. He would just have to be as quick as he could. Joseph left the cabin and found his sister splashing around in the pool with the other kids. Joseph asked the steward to bring their dinners to their cabin tonight, and as he led Ruthie back, he congratulated himself on surviving his first day as an adult. Until he opened the door, and his father was gone. Joseph dropped Ruthie's hand and got down on his hands and knees to search under the beds, but his father wasn't there. He wasn't in the cabin at all. "No, no," Joseph cried. He shook his mother, begged her to wake up, but the sleeping draft was too powerful. Joseph spun in the room, trying to figure out what to do. He snatched up Bitsy and put the little stuffed bunny into Ruthie's arms. "Stay here," he told Ruthie. "Stay here with Mama, and don't leave the cabin, understand? I've got to find Papa." Joseph ran out the door and into the passageway. But where to now? Where would his father go? Papa hadn't left the cabin the whole trip, and now he had decided to leave? Joseph heard a commotion, and he sprinted up the stairs to A-deck. Up ahead, a man was helping a woman to her feet, and both of them were looking angrily over their shoulders, the direction Papa must have run. And that's when Joseph remembered. His father had left the cabin before, to watch them bury Professor Viler at sea. Somewhere up ahead, a woman screamed, and Joseph took off at a run. He felt as though he was outside himself, like he existed outside his own skin, and he watched himself slam into the rail and look over the side. Someone yelled, "Man overboard!" and the ship's siren shrieked. Joseph's father had jumped into the sea.
Isabel. Somewhere on the Caribbean Sea, 1994. 3 days from home. Isabel woke to a warm orange glow on the horizon and a silver sea stretching out before them like a mirror. It was as though the storm had been some kind of feverish nightmare. Señor Castillo woke from his nightmare, too, parched like a man who'd been lost in the desert. He drank almost half of one of the few gallons of water they had left in one long chug, then laid back against the side of the boat. Isabel worried about her mother. For Mommy, the nightmare was just beginning. The illness she'd felt as the storm began had gotten worse in the night, and now she had a fever hotter than the rising sun. Lito dipped a scrap of shirt into the cool seawater and draped it across his daughter's forehead to cool her. But without the aspirin from the lost medicine box, there was no way to bring the fever down.
"The baby,"
Mommy moaned, holding her stomach.
"The baby will be fine," Lito told her. "A good, strong, healthy baby boy."
Lito and Señora Castillo took care of Isabel's mother. Papi and Luis got the engine restarted and bathed it with water to keep it cool. Amara, at the rudder, steered them north now that the sun was in the sky. Everybody had a job, it seemed, except Isabel and Ivan. Isabel bumped shoulders and stepped on toes as she wobbled her way over to Ivan in the prow of the boat. She sat down beside him with a huff.
"I feel useless," she told Ivan.
"I know," he said. "Me too."
They sat for a while in silence before Ivan said,
"Do you think we'll have to do algebra in our new American school?"
Isabel laughed.
"Yes." Will they have political rallies every day at school in the U.S.? Will we have to work in the fields all afternoon?
His eyes went wide.
Do you think we'll have to carry guns to protect us from all the shootings?
I don't know, Isabel told him. Their teachers told them all the time how homeless people starved in the streets of the U.S., and how people who couldn't afford to pay for doctors got sick and died, and how thousands of people were killed by guns every year. As happy as she had been to go to El Norte, Isabel suddenly worried that it wouldn't be as magical a place as everyone in the boat believed.
No matter what, I'm glad you came with us, Iván said. Now we can live next door to each other forever.
Isabel blushed and looked at her feet. She liked that thought, too. Castro's face was even more submerged now, which meant they were taking on water. Between the tanker and the storm, the little boat had suffered a pounding, and it had never been very seaworthy to begin with. Señor Castillo had only expected the boat to be on the water for a day, two at the most. How much longer would it take them to get to Florida? And where exactly were they?
Hey, is that land?
Iván asked. He pointed over the side of the boat. Isabel and the others scrambled so quickly to see that the boat tipped dangerously in the water. Yes, yes, Isabel could see it. A long, thin, dark green line along the blue horizon. Land.
Is it Florida?
Iván asked.
It's on the wrong side of the boat to be the U.S., Luis said, looking back at the sun. Unless we got blown into the Gulf of Mexico overnight.
Whatever it is, I'm steering for it, Amara told them. Everyone watched in silence as the green line turned into hills and trees, and the water got clearer and shallower. Isabel held her breath. She had never been so excited in her entire life. Was it really the United States? Had they made it? Amara brought them close to shore, then turned and ran south along it. Isabel searched the shore. There. She pointed to red and yellow beach umbrellas with chairs underneath them, and in the beach chairs were white people. A woman in a bikini lifted her black sunglasses and pointed at them, and the man with her sat up and stared. As the boat rounded the beach, Isabel saw more people, all staring and pointing and waving.
Yes! Yes, we made it! We made it! Isabel said, shaking Iván's arms.
Iván hopped up and down so much the boat groaned.
Florida! He cried.
A black man in a white suit hurried down the beach toward them, waving his arms over his head to get their attention. He yelled something in English and pointed for them to go farther south. Amara followed the shore around a bend, and the open ocean gave way to a quiet little bay with a long wooden pier. The pier had a little cafe on it with tables and chairs. Fancy two-man sailboats were parked on the beach next to volleyball courts, and more umbrellas and chairs dotted the sand. Isabel's heart leaped. The U.S. was even more of a paradise than she ever imagined. Luis flipped a switch, and the putter of the engine died. The white people got up from their tables at the bar to help pull them to the dock, and Isabel and the others reached for their hands. Their fingertips were almost close enough to touch when black men in white short-sleeve uniforms pushed their way between the vacationers on the pier and the boat. One of them said something in a language Isabel didn't understand.
I think he's asking us if we're from Haiti, Lito said to the others in the boat. We are from Cuba, he said slowly in Spanish to the uniformed man. You are from Cuba?
The officer asked in Spanish.
Yes, yes, they cried.
Where are we?
Papi asked.
The Bahamas,
the man said. The Bahamas? Isabel's mind went back to the map of the Caribbean on the wall of her schoolroom. The Bahamas were islands to the north and east of Havana, directly above the middle of Cuba. a long way east of Miami. Had the storm really taken them that far off course?
I'm sorry, the officer said, but you are not allowed to land. Bahamian law forbids the entrance of illegal aliens to the Bahamas. If you set foot on Bahamian soil, you will be taken into custody and returned to your country of origin.
Behind the officers, one of the tourists who knew Spanish was translating for the others. Some of them looked upset and started arguing with the authorities.
But we have a sick, pregnant woman, Lito said to the officer.
He moved so the men on the dock could see Isabel's mother, and the tourists behind the officers cried out in concern. The officers conferred, and Isabel held her breath.
The commandant says that for health reasons the pregnant woman may come ashore and receive medical attention, the Spanish-speaking officer said.
Isabel and Iván clutched at each other with hope.
But she cannot have her baby here, the officer said. As soon as she is well, she will be deported to Cuba.
Isabel and Iván sagged, and everyone else on the little boat was silent. Isabel felt sick. She wanted her mother to get better, but she didn't want them to be sent back to Cuba. Couldn't the Bahamas just let them stay? How was one more Cuban family going to hurt? She looked back at the pier and nice cafe. They had plenty of room. The situation was explained to the tourists on the pier, and they gasped and waited.
All right, Lito said. My daughter is sick. She needs medical attention. No, Papi said. You heard him. If we step off this boat, they'll send us back to Cuba. I'm not going back. Then I will go with her, Lito said. I care for Teresa's life more than I care for El Norte.
Tears ran down Isabel's cheeks. No, no. This wasn't the way things were supposed to happen. Her family was supposed to be together. That's why she'd insisted they all go on the boat. And if her mother went back to Cuba and her father went on to the United States, which one was she supposed to go with? Lito started to lift Isabel's mother, but Mommy pushed him away.
No, Isabel's mother said. But Teresa, Lito said. No, I don't want my baby born in Cuba. But you're ill. You can't take another ocean voyage, Lito argued. I will not go back, Mommy said.
She reached up and took her husband's and her daughter's hands.
I will stay with my family.
Relieved, Isabel threw herself into her mother's arms. She was surprised when she felt her father kneel down in the boat and hug them both.
It sounds like we're leaving, then,
Luis told everyone in the boat. Before they could get the engine restarted, one of the tourists tossed down a bottle of water to Señora Castillo. Soon the rest of the tourists were hurrying back and forth to the cafe, buying bottles of water and bags of chips, and tossing them into everyone's hands on the boat.
Aspirin? Does anyone have aspirin? For my mother?
Isabel begged. Up on the dock, an old white woman understood. She quickly dug around in her big purse and tossed a plastic bottle full of pills to Isabel.
Thank you! Thank you!
Isabel cried. Her heart ached with gratitude toward these people. Just a moment's kindness from each of them might mean the difference between death and survival for her mother and everyone else on the little raft. By the time they finally restarted the engine and Amara swung them around to leave, they had more food and water than they had brought with them to begin with. But they were farther away from Florida and freedom than they had ever been before.
Mahmoud, somewhere on the Mediterranean Sea, 2015, 11 days from home.
My baby,
Mahmoud's mother wailed.
My Hana is gone.
The Mediterranean was still attacking them, wave after wave trying to drown them, and Mahmoud could tell that his mother didn't want to fight anymore. It was all Mahmoud could do to keep her head above the water.
I'm still here, Mahmoud told her. I need you. I gave my baby to a stranger, Mahmoud's mother howled. I don't even know who she was. She's safe now, Mahmoud told her. Hannah is out of the water. She's going to live. But Mahmoud's mother would not be consoled. She lay back in the water, her face to the sky, and sobbed. The dinghy coming by had re-energized Mahmoud, but he could feel the buzz quickly draining away, replaced by a cold exhaustion that left his arms and legs numb. The sea rolled over him, and he went under again, coming up spluttering. He could not keep himself and his mother afloat. Not for long. They were going to die here. But at least Hannah was safe. Yes, he had been the one to convince a stranger to take his little sister away, and yes, his mother might never forgive herself for letting Hannah go, but at least neither of them would have to live long with their regret. The rain began again, the awful, pelting, deadening rain, and it felt to Mahmoud like Allah was crying for them, with them. They were drowning in tears. Under the sweeping wash of rain, Mahmoud heard something like a drumbeat. Water on something that was not water. He searched the rising and falling waves until he saw it. The backside of a life jacket still strapped to a man who floated face down in the water. In his mind's eye, Mahmoud immediately filled in the drowned man's face with that of his father, and his heart thumped against his own useless life jacket. He flailed in the water, half swimming, half towing his mother toward the body. But no, the life vest was blue, and his father's had been orange, like Mahmoud's. And this one was a real working life jacket. Mahmoud let his mother go for just a moment and wrestled the body over. It was the big man who had sat next to him on the dinghy. His eyes and mouth were open, but there was no life in either one. The man was dead. It wasn't the first dead body Mahmoud had seen. Not after 4 years of civil war, with his hometown right in the center of the fighting. A man had been killed right next to him in his family's car, he realized with a start. How long ago had that been? Days? Weeks? It seemed like a lifetime ago. But no matter how many times he saw death, it never stopped being horrifying. Mahmoud shuddered and recoiled. But if the man was dead, that meant he didn't need his life jacket. Mahmoud fought down his fear and fumbled with the straps on the dead man's life jacket. Mahmoud's fingers moved, but he couldn't feel them. His hands were like blocks of ice. He only knew he was touching the straps because he could see it happening. Finally, he got one strap unbuckled and another, and as the body began to shift in the vest, Mahmoud realized he was condemning this man to the bottom of the sea. He would never be bathed and wrapped in a kafan, never be mourned by those who loved him, never have his friends and family say prayers over him, never be buried facing Mecca. Mahmoud was putting a man in his grave, and he had a duty to him. Mahmoud had heard funeral prayers too many times in his short life, most recently for his cousin Saeed, who had died when a barrel bomb exploded. Mahmoud quietly recited one now. O God, forgive this man, and have mercy on him, and give him strength and pardon him. Be generous to him, and cause his entrance to be wide, and wash him with water and snow and hail. Cleanse him of his transgressions as white cloth is cleansed of stains. Give him an abode better than his home, and a family better than his family, and a wife better than his wife. Take him into paradise, and protect him from the punishment of the grave and from the punishment of hellfire. When he was finished, Mahmoud clicked open the last of the straps, and the man's body rolled out of the vest and down into the murky depths of the Mediterranean Sea. Here, Mom, put this on, Mahmoud said. It took some time to get her into the life jacket, Mahmoud doing most of the work. But at last it was on her, and Mahmoud no longer had to fight to keep her afloat. She lay on her back, eyes closed, muttering about Hannah, and Mahmoud clung to her life jacket. He still had to kick his legs to not pull them both under, but not nearly so much. He didn't know where they would go
or how they would get out of the water. Perhaps in the light of day they would see land and be able to swim for it. In the meantime, they had to survive the night.
Joseph. Just outside Havana Harbor, 1939. 18 days from home.
Help! My dad jumped overboard! Help! Joseph cried.
Far below him, already a couple hundred yards away from the ship, Joseph's father thrashed crazily in the water. He screamed incoherently, but he wasn't calling out for rescue. On the decks below, passengers ran to the rails and pointed. The ship's siren continued to blow, and sailors ran about, but nobody was doing anything. Joseph spun around helplessly. What was he supposed to do? Jump in after his father? It was such a long way down, and he didn't know how to swim. Down below, on C deck, one of the Cuban policemen tossed his cap and gun belt aside, kicked off his shoes, and jumped headlong into the green water. He hit the ocean with a slap and a splash, and for many seconds Joseph held his breath as though he was the diver himself. Joseph's lungs were just about to burst when the man broke the surface a few yards away from where he'd hit, gasping for breath. The man flipped the wet hair out of his face, spun until he had his bearings, and set off swimming for Joseph's father. Joseph's heart raced as fast as his feet as he flew down the stairs. He pushed through the crowds and ran to the rail, but the policeman hadn't yet reached his father. A woman screamed, and Joseph followed the pointing fingers. Two shark fins had appeared in the water. Joseph froze in terror. There were more screams as his papa sank beneath the waves and Joseph had to cling to the rail not to collapse. One of the St. Louis's lifeboats hit the water, and the ship's siren had brought motor launches from the shore. But none of them were going to be in time. The only person close enough to save Joseph's father was the Cuban policeman. Even though the sharks still circled, the policeman took a deep breath and dived beneath the waves. Joseph counted the long seconds before the man broke the surface again, this time with Papa in his arms. The passengers on the ship cheered, but Joseph's father didn't want to be rescued. He struggled in the man's arms, beating and flailing at him.
"Murderers!" he cried. "They'll never take me!"
But Papa was weak, and the policeman was strong. One of the motor launches from shore reached them first, and the policeman helped the other men lift Joseph's father into the boat.
"Let me die! Let me die!"
Joseph's father cried. The words struck Joseph like slaps to the face, and tears sprang to his eyes. His father would rather die than be with his son, his daughter, his wife. The crack of a pistol shot made Joseph jump. One of the men in the boat stood aiming a gun down into the water near the policeman.
"Pack, pack!"
He shot twice more, and one of the shark fins turned away from the policeman to attack the shark the man had wounded with his pistol. The men laid Joseph's father in the bottom of the boat and helped the weary policeman aboard. There were sighs of relief and whispered prayers on the St. Louis, but Joseph's heart lurched when he saw his father kick away the man trying to help him. Papa lunged for the side of the small boat, trying to get back to the sea.
"Let me die!" he cried out again.
The policeman grabbed him and pulled him back in the boat. Two more of the men restrained him, and the boat quickly turned and sped toward the shore. The St. Louis's siren stopped blasting, and suddenly it was over. All around Joseph, passengers wept. But Joseph now felt more stunned than sad. His father was gone. In many ways, his father had never really come back from the concentration camp. Not the father Joseph knew and remembered. Not the father he loved. He had come back in body, but not in spirit. Joseph's father was gone. His mother was unconscious. His little sister was all by herself. And they would never let Joseph's family into Cuba now. Not after his father had gone mad. Joseph and his family would all be sent back to Germany, back to the Nazis. Joseph's world was falling apart, and he didn't see any way to put it back together again.
Isabel. Somewhere between the Bahamas and Florida, 1994. 4 days from home. The little boat was falling apart. The seams between the sides had cracks in them. The engine rattled in its mounting, constantly weakening the bolts that held it in place. Even the benches were coming loose. Only Castro hadn't cracked. He stared up at Isabel as stern and confident as ever, commanding her to fight against the impossible and win. But it was hard to fight against the inevitable. The water in the boat was almost to Isabel's knees. She and the others worked sluggishly in the blazing hot Caribbean sun to scoop, pitch, but water was seeping in as fast as they could bail it. The boat was sinking. Every empty water bottle and gasoline can had been tucked up under a bench to help keep them afloat, but if they didn't reach Florida soon, they were all going to drown.
Fight against the impossible and win, Isabel told herself.
When are we going to get there? Iván whined.
Mañana, Lito said wearily. Mañana.
Suddenly, Isabel's grandfather stopped bailing water. He sat up straighter, like he was looking at something in the distance.
Mañana,
he whispered.
Lito?
Isabel asked. Her grandfather blinked and his eyes found her again. Was he crying? Or was it just sweat and seawater?
It's nothing, Chabela. Just a memory. Something I haven't thought about in a long time.
Isabel's grandfather gazed around the little boat, and his eyes suddenly looked sadder, Isabel thought. She would have crawled over and hugged him, but there was no room to do it without three people getting up and moving for her to get there.
Don't stop bailing,
Señor Castillo told them from where he lay in the bottom of the boat.
Maybe you could help, Papi told him. I'm recovering,
Señor Castillo argued.
I can barely move in this heat. Besides, I don't see you bailing. I'm tending to my wife, Papi said, who's really sick.
Ever since the Bahamas, something had come over Isabel's father. He'd been more attentive to Mommy, more focused on her than anything else. Nobody else noticed, but Isabel did. She'd seen him hold her hand, watched him gently move her hair out of her face, heard him whispering that he loved her, that he needed her. Things she had never seen or heard him do before.
Are you saying my father is faking it? Luis challenged. I'm just saying it's very nice for him that everybody else is keeping this metal coffin afloat, while he sits back and relaxes,
Papi said.
You wouldn't even have this metal coffin if I hadn't built it.
I'm not sure if built is the right word,
Señora Castillo said, trying to pull two of the side pieces back together.
Cobbled is more like it.
Iván and Señor Castillo erupted at the same time.
We did the best we could,
Iván yelled.
Oh, now you're telling us how to build things?
Señor Castillo said.
Where were you and Luis when we were up all night putting this thing together, eh? You were at your law office, doing God knows what.
Isabel shrank in her seat and put her hands over her ears. She hated when her parents argued like this, and now everyone on the boat was mad at each other.
I was helping people,
Señora Castillo told her husband.
You've never appreciated what I do. And what was I supposed to do?
Luis threw in.
Tell my police commander I had to stay home and build a boat so I could escape? All of you, stop it!
Amara yelled from the back of the boat.
Right now! You're acting like children!
Everyone fell quiet and looked appropriately chastised.
I think it's time for a water break,
Amara told them.
Isabel? Will you hand out the bottles?
It was a little earlier than their rationed water break, but none of them complained. The clear, delicious water was the best thing Isabel had ever tasted, and it settled them all down like mother's milk for a baby.
We're all hot, and we're all tired, and yes, we're sinking, Amara said. But if we lose our heads, we're only going to die faster. We can resolve this.
She's right, Isabel's father said. I'm sorry. I'm sorry too, Señor Castillo said. I should be helping.
Only if you're up to it,
Papi said, and he sounded like he meant it.
The boat is falling apart, though, Iván said. We're taking on too much water.
We have too much weight,
Señora Castillo said. She was right, but what could they lose? There was just the engine, the fuel, the food and water, and the nine of them.
What if one or two of us slipped out into the water at a time? Papi suggested. They could hang on to the boat. Floating in the water alongside would help take some of the weight away.
But it would drag on the boat, slow us down, Luis said.
But it might keep the boat afloat longer, Señor Castillo said.
I think we should try it, Amara said. We'll take turns in the water. It'll keep us cooler, too.
And right now, Isabel thought, cooler heads just might be the most important thing of all.
Mahmoud, somewhere on the Mediterranean Sea, 2015, 11 days from home. Mahmoud was in and out of sleep, waking every few seconds when the waves washed over him. Minutes, hours passed, and Mahmoud dreamed that a boat was coming for them. He could hear its motor over the lapping of the waves. Mahmoud jerked awake. He ran a wet, cold hand down his face, trying to focus, and he heard it again, the sound of a motor. He wasn't dreaming, but where was it? The rain had stopped, but it was still dark. He couldn't see the boat, but he could hear it. Here! He cried. Here! But the sound of the motor still stayed frustratingly, agonizingly far away. If only whoever was on the boat could see him, Mahmoud thought. All his life he'd practiced being hidden, unnoticed. Now, at last, when he most needed to be seen, he was truly invisible. Mahmoud cried in exhaustion and misery. He wanted to do it all over again. He wanted to go back and stand up for the boy in the alley in Aleppo who was getting beaten up for his bread. To scream and yell and wake the sleeping citizens of Izmir so they would see him and all the other people sleeping in doorways and parks. To tell Bashar al-Assad and his army to go to hell. He wanted to stop being invisible and stand up and fight. But now he would never get a chance to do any of that. It was too late. There was no time. Time. The phone! Mahmoud still had the phone in his pocket. He pulled it out and pushed the button on it through the plastic bag, and the screen with the clock on it lit up like a beacon in the night. Mahmoud held it over his head and waved it in the dark, screaming and yelling for help. The motor got louder. Mahmoud wept for joy as a boat emerged from the darkness. A real boat this time, not a dinghy. A speedboat with lights and antennas and blue and white stripes on the side. The colors of the Greek flag. A Greek Coast Guard ship come to save them. And on the front of the ship, down on his knees with hands clasped in thanks, was Mahmoud's father. Walid was there too, in the back under a foil thermal blanket. And soon Mahmoud and his mother were out of the water and wrapped in the foil blankets too, what little body heat they still had left reflected back at them. Mahmoud's mother was too insensible to speak, so Mahmoud told his father how they had given Hannah away, rather than see her drown with them. Mahmoud's father wept, but pulled Mahmoud to him and hugged him. "Hannah's not with us, but she's alive, I know it," his father told him. "Because of you, my son."
The Greek Coast Guard boat swept through the choppy Mediterranean the rest of the night, pulling more people out of the water. The Coast Guard finally set Mahmoud and his family, and all the other refugees, down on the island of Lesbos. It was almost 6 o'clock in the morning, and the sky was beginning to lighten with the dawn. Mahmoud wasn't sure, but he thought he and his mother had spent more than 2 hours in the water. When they stepped off the boat, Mahmoud's father got down on his hands and knees and kissed the ground and gave thanks to Allah. It was time for morning prayers anyway, and Mahmoud joined him. When they were finished, Mahmoud staggered up the rocky gray shore, squinting at the hills that rose just beyond the beach. Then he realized they weren't real hills. They were piles and piles of life jackets. There were mountains of them, stretching up and down the coast as far as Mahmoud could see. The way Aleppo had its piles of rubble, Lesbos had its piles of life jackets, abandoned by the hundreds of thousands of refugees who had come before them, shedding the vests they no longer needed and moving along on the road to somewhere else. There were bodies on the beach, too. People who hadn't survived the sea in the night, who hadn't been found by the Coast Guard in time. Men, mostly, but a few women, too. And a child. Mahmoud's mother rushed to the infant, howling Hannah's name. Mahmoud hurried after her, horrified, but the child wasn't Hannah. It was someone else's baby daughter, her lungs filled with seawater. Mahmoud's mother cried into his shoulder until a Greek man in a uniform moved them both away from the body and recorded the infant in a little notebook, tallying the daily dead. Mahmoud staggered away, feeling as numb as if he were in the freezing water again. Mahmoud's mother went to all the other refugees who had landed in the night and were still there, asking each of them if they had seen her little Hannah. But none of them had. The boat with Mahmoud's little sister on it was gone. It had either reached the island and its passengers had already moved on, or it too had wrecked on the rocks. Mahmoud's mother fell to her knees on the rocky ground and wept, and Mahmoud's father held her close and let her cry. Mahmoud felt gutted. It was all his fault. Hannah might still be with them if he hadn't gotten someone on that boat to take her. Or she might have died during their 2 hours in the water. Either way, they had lost her. Mahmoud, his father said quietly over his sobbing mother, check the other bodies and see if they have any shoes that will fit us.
Joseph. Just outside Havana Harbor, 1939. 19 days from home. Joseph wished he was invisible. Once the rest of the passengers discovered who had jumped overboard yesterday, everyone stopped to tell him how sorry they were, how everything would be all right. But how could it be all right? How could it ever be all right? Joseph stood at the rail on A deck where his father had jumped. Down below, the sea was no longer empty. It was dotted with little motorboats and rowboats. Some carried reporters, shouting up questions and trying to get pictures of the ship. Other boats offered up bunches of fresh bananas and bags of coconuts and oranges. Passengers on C deck tossed money down, and the fruit was passed up the ladder by the Cuban policemen guarding the top and the bottom. Lately, though, the boats were full of relatives of people on board. Mostly men, they had come ahead to Cuba to get jobs and find places for their families to live. One man brought the same little white dog every day and held it up for his wife to wave to. The boats with relatives came close enough for their families to yell back and forth a little, but they couldn't get any closer. Thanks to Joseph's father, a handful of Cuban police boats now surrounded the St. Louis. They kept the rescue ships at a distance and watched for anyone else who tried to jump to freedom or death. At night, the Cuban police boats swept the hull with searchlights, and the St. Louis's crew members, on the captain's orders, patrolled the decks on suicide watch.
"Evelina, there he is! There's Papa!" Renata cried.
She stood a few paces away from Joseph down the rail, trying to point out one of the little rowboats to her sister.
"Where? I don't see him!" Evelina whined.
Joseph was more interested in the small police boat that had navigated its way through the flotilla
and was pulling up to the St. Louis. Any time they had a visitor now, it was cause for conversation, and soon word spread throughout the ship that the boat had brought the Cuban policeman who had saved Joseph's father. Joseph ran down to fetch his mother and sister, and together they hurried to the social hall, where a group of passengers and crew gathered to give the Cuban policeman a hero's welcome. They parted for the policeman, cheering and slapping him on the back and shaking hands with him as he went. It was the first time he had been back to the ship since jumping overboard to save Joseph's father, and Joseph and his family strained to get a good look at him over the heads of the other passengers. Joseph's mother cried and put a hand to her mouth, and Joseph felt a surge of affection for the policeman. This was the man who had saved his father's life. The policeman seemed genuinely flattered and surprised by all the attention. He was a short, stocky man with olive skin, a wide face, and a thick mustache. He wore blue pants, a gray shirt with epaulets on the shoulders, and a matching gray beret. Around his waist was a leather belt with a nightstick and holster hanging from it. His name, they were told, was Mariano Padron. Captain Schroeder arrived to thank Officer Padron on behalf of the passengers and crew. Joseph felt a ripple of tension spread throughout the room. Joseph had seen the captain less and less as the hot days of waiting at anchor dragged on, and he wasn't the only passenger who had noticed. But they were there to celebrate Officer Padron, not badger the captain about why they were still on the ship. The mood became happy again when the policeman was presented with a gift of 150 Reichsmarks that had been collected from grateful passengers. Officer Padron was stunned, and so was Joseph. 150 Reichsmarks was a lot of money, especially for people who might need that money later to pay for visas and entrance fees. Officer Padron tried to refuse the money, but the passengers wouldn't hear of it. "I was just doing my job," Officer Padron told the audience through a translator. "But I will never forget this. I will never forget any of you. Thank you." The passengers applauded again, and while many of them turned their attention to the captain to ask him for a status report, Joseph and his mother and sister pushed forward to talk to the policeman. Officer Padron's eyes lit up at the sight of Joseph's mother. He said something in Spanish, and the passenger who had spoken for him in front of the crowd smiled and translated his words. "Señora, your father was a thief?" Joseph's mother frowned. "A thief? My father? No, I don't understand." "Your father, he must be a thief," Officer Padron said through the translator, "because he stole the stars from the sky and put them in the señora's eyes." Joseph finally understood. It was some kind of compliment about how pretty she was. His mother smiled politely but impatiently. "Officer Padron, what about my husband?" she asked. "Is he all right? They won't let me go ashore and see him." The policeman took off his hat. "I am so sorry, so very sorry, Señora Landau. Yes, your husband is alive," he said through the interpreter. "He is in the hospital. He has been..." Officer Padron said something more, but the translator frowned. It was beyond his limited Spanish. Officer Padron could see his confusion, and he pantomimed what he meant by turning his wrists upside down, closing his eyes, and lolling his head back like he was asleep. "Sedated," Mama said. There was pain in her voice. Joseph knew she blamed herself. The whole reason her husband was gone was because she had been sedated and unable to stop him. Officer Padron nodded. "It's not good," he said through the interpreter, "but he will live." Joseph's mother took both of the policeman's hands in her own and kissed them. "Thank you, Officer Padron." She spoke in German, but the policeman seemed to understand. He blushed and nodded. Then he spied Ruthie, half hidden behind her mother's skirt, and knelt down to her. He put his policeman's beret on her head and said something in Spanish, and she smiled. "He says you're the policewoman now," the translator said. "He will be the criminal. You must catch him." Officer Padron led Ruthie on a merry chase around the room, Ruthie squealing. Joseph's mother laughed through a sob. It was the first time Joseph had heard her laugh or seen her smile in months.
Officer Padron let Ruthie catch him, and he plucked the hat off Ruthie's head and put it on Joseph's head, speaking in Spanish again.
"He says it's your turn," the translator said. "Oh, no," Joseph said. He waved a hand to make sure the policeman understood. He wasn't in the mood for fun and games, and besides, he was too old for that kind of thing.
Officer Padron tapped Joseph's chest with the back of his hand, urging him to play.
"He says he is the passenger," the translator said.
Officer Padron raised himself up in mock anger and spoke in Spanish.
"You, Señor Policeman," the translator said. "When will we leave the ship?"
The happy mood suddenly disappeared. Joseph and his family and the translator all looked at each other awkwardly. Officer Padron had only meant to mimic what everyone asked him all the time, but the question made Joseph sag. It felt like they were never getting off this ship. Officer Padron realized his mistake immediately and looked anguished at having brought it up. He nodded in sympathy. Then, in unison, he and Joseph spoke the answer all the Cuban guards always gave. Mañana.
Isabel. Somewhere between the Bahamas and Florida, 1994. 5 days from home. Isabel slipped over the side of the boat into the sea and sighed. The water was warm, but it felt much cooler than being in the boat. The sun was just setting on the western horizon, turning the world into a sepia-toned photograph, but it still had to be close to 100 degrees outside. If it wouldn't have swamped their boat and drowned them all for good, Isabel would have prayed for rain to break the muggy heat. Isabel's father had rigged up a makeshift sunshade out of his shirt for her mother, and she seemed better now. The aspirin had kept Mommy's fever down, and though she was still exhausted and near to bursting with Isabel's baby brother, she seemed at peace somehow. Hot, but at peace. If the rest of them wanted relief, they had to wait for their turn in the water. Again, Isabel thought of their journey as a song. If the riots and trading for the gasoline were the first verse, and the tanker and the storm the second verse, this part of their trip, the long, hot, stagnant day and a half they had been traveling from the Bahamas to Florida, this was the bridge. A third verse that was different from the others. This verse was death by slow measures. This was the down-tempo lull before the coming excitement of the climactic last verse and coda. This was limbo. They could do nothing but wait. The last sliver of sun finally disappeared below the waves, and Luis cut the engine. The world went silent, but for the soft lapping of water against the hull and the creak of their disintegrating boat.
"That's it," Luis said. "With the sun down, we won't be able to navigate as well."
"Can't we use the stars?" Isabel asked. She remembered reading that sailors had used the stars to navigate for centuries.
"Which one?"
Luis asked. None of them knew. Amara lifted one of the gasoline jugs and swished around what little there was left in it.
"Saves us gas, anyway," she said. "The thing's been eating it up. We'll be lucky to have enough to get to shore when we see land."
"When will we get there?" Iván asked.
He was bobbing in the water just ahead of Isabel, hanging on to the hull like she was.
"Tomorrow, hopefully,"
Señor Castillo said from inside the boat. It was the same thing he'd said yesterday, and the day before that.
"Mañana,"
Isabel's grandfather whispered. He was treading water on the other side of the boat with Señora Castillo, his head just visible over the side. He'd been whispering that word off and on since yesterday, and still seemed shaken up somehow. Isabel didn't know why.
"We'll see the lights of Miami sometime tomorrow, and we'll head straight for it,"
Mommy said. She shifted and winced uncomfortably.
"What is it? Are you all right?"
Papi asked. Isabel's mother put a hand on her belly.
"I think it's begun."
"What's begun?"
Papi asked.
Then his eyes went wide.
You mean the baby's coming? Here? Now?
Everyone in the boat perked up, and Isabel and Iván pulled themselves up on the side of the boat to see. Isabel was a jumble of emotions. She was excited to see her brother born after waiting so long. But suddenly she was also afraid. Afraid for her mother to have the baby here, on this fragile raft in the middle of the ocean. And worried, too, for the first time, about how her baby brother would change her fragile family.
Yes, I think I've gone into labor, Isabel's mother said calmly. But no, I am not having the baby here and now. The contractions are just starting. It took Isabel another 10 hours to come after my contractions began, remember?
Isabel had never heard her mother talk about her birth before, and she was both curious and a little weirded out at the same time.
What are you going to name him?
Iván asked. Mommy and Papi looked at each other.
We haven't decided yet, she said.
Well, I have some good ideas if you want some, Iván said.
We're not naming him after Industriales players, Isabel told him,
and Iván stuck his tongue out at her. They were all quiet for a time, and Isabel watched as the golden horizon shifted from orange to purple to deep blue. Would her baby brother be born at sea, or in the United States? Would the end of their song really be a new life in Miami? Or would it end in tragedy for all of them, adrift, out of gas, and dying of thirst in the great saltwater desert of the Atlantic?
Hey, we never named our boat,
Iván said. Everyone moaned and laughed.
What?
Iván said, smiling.
Every good boat needs a name.
I think we all agree this isn't a good boat,
Señor Castillo said.
But it's the boat that's taking us to the States, to freedom, Iván said. It deserves a name.
How about Fidel?
Luis joked, kicking up a splash on Castro's face at the bottom of the boat.
No, no, no,
Papi said.
El ataúd flotante.
The floating coffin. Isabel winced at the name. It wasn't funny. Not with her mother about to have a baby on the boat.
Too close, Señor Castillo agreed. How about me piro?
He suggested. It was slang for I'm out of here in Cuba.
Chao, pescao,
Mommy said, and everyone laughed. It literally meant goodbye, fish, but everyone in Cuba said it to each other to say goodbye.
This St. Louis,
Isabel's grandfather said softly. Everyone was quiet for a moment, trying to figure out the joke, but no one understood.
How about el camello?
Luis said. The camel was what they called the ugly humpbacked buses pulled around by tractors in Havana.
No, no, I've got it,
Amara cried.
El botero.
It was perfect, because it was the slang word for the taxis in Havana, but it actually meant the boatman. All the adults laughed and clapped.
No, no,
Iván said, frustrated.
It needs a cool-sounding name, like the...
Iván jumped a little in the water, and his eyes went wide.
The what?
Isabel asked. Then she jumped, too, as something hard and leathery bumped into her leg.
Shark!
Screamed Isabel's grandfather from the other side of the boat.
Shark!
The water around Iván became a dark red cloud, and Isabel screamed. Something bumped into her again, and Isabel scrambled to climb into the boat, arms and legs shaking, panic thundering in her chest. Her father grabbed her around her middle, and they fell back in a tumble inside the boat. Beside them, Amara and Mami helped pull Señora Castillo into the boat as Lito pushed her up out of the water from behind. Isabel and her father scrabbled to their knees and pulled her grandfather in behind her. On the other side of the boat,
Luis and Señor Castillo cried out Iván's name as they hauled his limp body over the side. Iván's right leg was a bloody mess. There were small bites all over it, as though a gang of sharks had attacked all at once. Raw, red, gaping wounds exposed the muscle underneath his skin. Isabel fell back against the side of the boat in horror. She'd never seen anything so awful. She felt like she was going to throw up. Señora Castillo wailed. Iván was so shocked he didn't even cry out, didn't speak. His eyes had a glazed look to them, and his mouth hung open. One of the gashes up near his thigh was pumping blood out like a garden hose, and Isabel watched as Iván's face grew pale. She couldn't speak.
A tourniquet, Lito cried. We have to get something around his leg to stop the bleeding.
Isabel's father yanked off his belt, and Lito tied it as high around Iván's leg as he could. But the blood still flowed, coloring the water all around them in the boat a dark, sickening red.
No! No!
Señor Castillo cried, as the life went out of Iván's eyes. Isabel wanted to scream too, but she was frozen. There was nothing she could do. There was nothing any of them could do. Iván was dead. Luis yelled in rage and pulled his police pistol from its holster.
Bang! Bang, bang!
He fired once, twice, three times at the fin that circled the boat.
No!
Lito said, grabbing Luis's hand before he could shoot again.
You'll just bring more sharks with the blood in the water.
Too late. Another fin appeared, and another. And soon the nameless little boat was surrounded. They were trapped in their own sinking prison.
Mahmoud, Lesbos, Greece, to Athens, Greece, 2015. 12 days from home. Mahmoud was in another tent city,